Okay, so now I'm going to go through a few models. I don't think there's any theory in there of interaction. Okay, so again, this is a sampling that I did. It's completely biased. I pick things that I know about and things I like. And even pick one of my own things. So it's, and on top of that, it's self-serving. So this is really an interesting piece of work. Pretty old, I think it was 88 maybe. Called morphological analysis of input devices. And this was done by Stukar, Jeff McKinley, and George Robertson at Xerox PARC. And this three people, plus Tom Moran, who also was at Xerox PARC for a long time, have done a lot of work in HCI that gets cited over and over again. They looked at this thing I'm going to talk about, the input devices. Stukar did a lot of work on mouse and pointing, and all the early work that validated the fact that the mouse was a good pointing device. They also did a lot of work, fundamental and seminal work in information visualization, in testing the, we were talking about animation earlier on. The effect of animation, when it works, when it doesn't, etc., etc. So here what they wanted to do was to describe input devices, and that was at the time where there were starting to be a flurry of new devices, from joysticks to touch surfaces to various 3D sensing devices. And so they wanted to capture these properties of input devices that often get lost when you plug your USB cable into your computer, and all the computer sees is XY position in the state of a few buttons. So they defined an input device as a transducer of the physical properties captured by the device into logical properties that are made available to the system. So it's defined by this tuple here, where you have the type of operation that the user is doing. So is it acting on the position of the object, or is it applying a force, like to a force sensitive joystick? And is the device sensing relative changes or absolute values? If I have a touch screen, it's going to be an absolute value, I know the XY position. If I have a mouse, it's relative because I only sense the motion. So changes in position, not absolute position. If I lift the mouse, I put it here, the device itself doesn't sense that. Are we sensing linear or circular positions or changes in position? The input and output domain is the range of input values and output values. The resolution function is what maps the input values to the output values. So what they call the resolution function here is what I called earlier on the transfer function. It transfers input to output for a mouse, for example. That's where the, quote, acceleration of the mouse would take place. And then the device has a current state, so for example, if it has buttons, the buttons can be pressed or not. And so they create this language to build input devices out of three operations: merging, layout, and connection. So merging means that I take different devices and I put them inside the same object. So the fact that the mouse moves left and right, they call this a merge. The fact that the mouse has buttons, they call it a layout, because I took buttons and I stick them on the mouse. I must say, merge and layout to me were not always obviously different. But then there is the connect. And the connect means that one device is affecting the state of another device, and they consider the cursor on the screen as an input device, which I think is a clever way to think of it, because it decouples the device you're moving physically with its representation on the screen. And as we saw with things like semantic pointing, you could have, at the level of the cursor, the equivalent of the transfer function here. So what they do with this is essentially they map the space of input devices. This is an example from their paper, which I don't find particularly relevant. But it was looking at the radio control. We have a volume button that you can rotate along the z-axis. You can rotate from 0 to 270 degrees. The state is the angle of rotation. The resolution is the identity. There's no transformation here. And then it connects to the volume of the sound in the range 0 to C times, C being the output here, times to 70, I don't know why, times to 70. So this gives you a way to describe a physical interface of an object here, like a radio. Now, what I think is the most interesting contribution here is that they create a design space. And that's something we do very often when we do some, basic research in HCI, is we try to create design spaces. A space where there are things that already exist, and where you want to identify holes, places that have not been explored. Because that's a generative process by which you can say, well, oh, here we have a mouse. A mouse is sensing a difference in position in X and Y. The other thing here would represent the radio that I showed below. So in this table you have whether I'm sensing a position or a change in position or a force or a change in force. Vertically, it tells whether I'm sensing X, Y, Z in a linear way or rotation along the three axes. And within each box here, whether I'm left or right, gives an idea of the resolution of the device. So a mouse in X and Y has large resolution, but the button is to the left because it can be either on or off. We don't have, in most mice, we don't have pressure-sensitive buttons. So what they did is they mapped here all of the devices they could find at the time. And what they found is that you had many things sensing position, so therefore absolute things like tablets and light pens and touch panels and touch screens. A few changing the change in position, so relative devices, the mouse is here, but there's, I don't know which what this Tesla thing is here. A few were sensing force. And none of them were sensing changes in force. And then you have an overwhelmed majority of things sensing only X and Y linearly, a few also sensing a Z position. And then when you go to rotary things, there are fewer things. In fact, the proportion of the difference in angle is larger than the absolute. So this is a way to compare a bunch of devices which in the end will send something controlling, in many, many of these cases, an X and Y on the screen. But of course, for the user, all these devices are going to be different. And some are going to work better than others for particular tasks. And also by looking at this, I mean, it's pretty crowded, but I can also look at, you know, why are some things almost empty, and could I fill those empty boxes. So that's an example where the model of input device is based on understanding the dimensions that are being sensed, and the other aspect was understanding how an input device can be decomposed into components, and how these components are assembled.
Okay, so that's called, so I called it the design space. Oftentimes it's also called the taxonomy. The difference is that when you say a taxonomy, you essentially enumerate and classify things. When you talk about design space, you add the generative aspect that in this space there are things yet to explore. The taxonomy is more descriptive. It tells you about what exists and how to look at it according to certain criteria or property. The design space can be based on taxonomy, but it emphasizes the part that are still open for exploration. Now here's another example that was created to help describe interactive systems. And here the goal is to describe interaction techniques. So it's called the user action notation. It's called the notation. It doesn't pretend to be what it's not. It's just a convenient way to describe interaction in graphical user interfaces. And then the goal or the hope was to, based on this notation, being able maybe to have tools that to do analysis of interaction or maybe even do prediction of performance. So this could be hooked up with the GOMS model that we're going to see in a minute. And you know, there's nothing really fancy there. It describes the basic actions that you have in the graphical user interface. The mouse actions are described with an M and a little V or a little hat for mouse down and mouse up. The tilde means moving the mouse. And then you can decide to enrich the notation with things you need for the level of description you want. So you can use square brackets to describe the context. So here the action would be to move the pointer onto an icon, and then to do mouse down and up, that is to click. And the feedback here would be described as icon exclamation mark, which means highlight the icon. Now, the point here is that you can describe interaction at several levels of granularity. So, oftentimes in interfaces, the feedback for the selection occurs when you click on the button, not when you release it. So, a more accurate version would be to say you move the cursor to the icon, then you push the button down. Then the icons, so the icons that are, all the icons that were selected become non-selected, and the icon, if the icon was not selected, it becomes selected. So it describes the interaction in more detail. And then when you have this feedback, and then you release the button. Here is another notation for moving an icon. So you move onto a file icon, then you click down, then you move the cursor with the button down from a certain position to another position, and then you release the button. And the feedback is going to be the same feedback as the selection. Then the outline of the icon is going to move, and then at the end you display the icon at the destination position. So there's nothing fancy about this. The advantage is that you can describe interaction with just ASCII characters. It can be extended if needed. You can create new symbols. You can create new columns in the tables. In a sense, the interaction tables I talked about in last class could use the UAN notation to describe the interactions. And in a sense, I think we should have more of this, because it's so hard to talk about interaction. And if all we have is to show snapshots of the display to show what it looks like, it's very limiting. And I think having better ways to describe interaction would be a good start. And it's kind of interesting that there's no such notation that has emerged and that has been used widely. So that's why in
put this in here, it's because I think it's a good idea that sort of maybe it's not sexy enough for people to to use it, but it serves a real purpose.
Yes. I don't know if you know, but Cocoa now has a visual format for describing layouts, and it's something like this.
In what? In Cocoa?
Cocoa, in macOS development. You can describe it with a string, the layout of seed file.
Okay.
For example, if you want
two buttons to be close enough, you have bracket, name of the button, bracket, line, and the other button in ASCII character.
They are using ASCII art to describe alignments and stuff like that.
Okay. Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
We watched the video yesterday.
Okay, so thank you for keeping me up to date. I think notations are important because, you know, even though they don't call them models, in a sense, when you do this thing, when you design a notation, you make some decisions about what it is you're abstracting out, what it is you're not describing, and what it is you're describing. Now, as a notation, as I said, it's open. You can add new symbols and things like this. But it is a problem that we don't have a proper language in computer terms to describe interaction. Which leads me to state machines. And I think by now you've been using state machines a bit. Now this is work that was done, I think the first article by William Newman on using state machines is from 1968. So not a new thing. And it's kind of a thing that's been killed because it's been done, and since it's been done, it's not interesting anymore. Even though I think it's useful. So at the time, in the late 70s and the 80s, and especially when graphical user interfaces started to become more widespread, at least in the research community, there was a lot of work on describing interaction through some sort of automaton or machine. So they had the augmented transition networks, the ATN, the RTNs, the recursive transition networks, where inside the state you could have another machine. David Harrell created state charts, which was used not primarily for describing user interfaces, but could certainly be used for that. And PetriNets are a much more sophisticated model. They all share similar aspects. First, they all share the fact that they are easily depicted through graphs like this one, where you have states and transitions between states. This is both a good thing and a bad thing, because you can describe fairly complex interactions through fairly simple diagrams. But then when it comes to turning this diagram into a program, you lose this, I'm tempted to say Gestaltian perception of, I see a cycle here or a symmetry or something. When you turn it into code, even if you create a specific language, when you turn it into text, the structure disappears. So they all share these graphical aspects and these networks between states and transitions. They all share the notion that behind this, there is a solid mathematical model for which you can actually validate properties and make mathematical proofs. So I can prove that a can always get back to the original state, for example. All interactions should be reinitializable, and these kind of things. And finally, all these models can be easily turned into an implementation, so they are executable. So having something where you can do mathematical proofs and that are executable is actually a good thing in software engineering. Funny thing is, because people played with that in the 80s, and because we went to a model where everybody was using listeners and handlers and callbacks in one form or the other, state machines disappeared, and I'm one of the people who did work on this more recently, and so that gave the sweepstakes things that you've been using.
But it was not easy to publish the thing because people say, oh, it's been done. Well, it was not done the way we did it, I think. And the point is, it was still very useful and there was still nothing else to create and describe interaction in an effective way. So I think it's another problem in HCI that we often shy away from things that are a little bit too formal. And I think same machines scare people because there is this underlying formal aspect. But I think on the contrary, we should take advantage of that. If we can prove that, I can always go from any state into any other state in my interface, I think that would be an interesting property to be able to show on the static analysis of your code rather than having to test it by hand time and again. And by the way, testing of interactive systems is a very, very tricky thing because there's very few systems that do automated testing of interactive software. So these things will link a little bit with the last part on software architectures. But in terms of models that have been created by HCI people for HCI people, Gans is probably the most well-known and the most extensive one. And in fact, Gans is a family of models, or was thought of as a family of models to be able to describe interaction at various levels of abstraction or granularity. And that was a family of models that were meant to be predictive as well as descriptive. So GOMS itself stands for goals, operations, operators, methods, and selection rules. And the idea is to describe the interactive system in terms of these four things. What the goals, what the user wants to do. So a goal can be to enter text or to replace all occurrences of this by that. So it's user's goal in sort of the sense of a Norman's action theory. Then there is the operators, and these are the actions that are supported by the software. So what are the things I can do that the system will understand? So I can move the cursor, I can point, I can click, I can enter text, maybe I can speak if I have a speech recognition system, etc., etc. Then there are the methods, and these are the sequences of operators that users have learned to use in conjunction to achieve a particular sub-goal in general, not the overall goal, but more low-level goals. So operators and methods are not unlike, well, they're not like either, but you could connect them with this notion of operations and actions in action theory. Because those learned sequences, if I tell you, select or replace this word by that word, you're going to do a set of actions without thinking, moving your cursor to the word, double-clicking to select the word, and typing the new word. These are level of actions in operations in activity theory. So there is kind of a match here. And then there's the selection rules, is that for a given goal, there may be several methods to reach that goal. So again, in the context of text editing, it can be that I'm using the mouse to select text, or I can also move the cursor with the keyboard. So it gives me at least two methods to achieve the same thing. Now, every time you have various ways to do the same thing, you need to choose one. And so the selection rules describe how you make the decision. When it comes to things like text editing or many tasks, you'll usually try to optimize for speed. Not always, but that's typically good criterion. So with GOMS, you can both describe the user task through the set of goals and the various methods that are available to the users to achieve those goals. And a set of models that can be used at several levels of abstraction and some of them are predictive. They allow you to predict which method is going to be most efficient. So underlying the GAMS models, there is the an implicit theory, not implicit actually, an explicit theory of considering humans as an information processing machine. There's the model human processor, which is which was published by the same authors here at the same time. And the idea is that, you know, it's an information processing machine. So you get input from the world through your senses, you process it, and then you produce output. It's not unlike, again, Norman's action theory. It's very simple and even simplistic. It doesn't really take into account what happens when things break down or these kind of things. But again, as I said when I introduced models, when you do a model, you want to simplify things make it possible to study and to do something with your model. And then you don't want to simplify too much, but if you don't simplify enough, you're not going to be able to do anything. So I think the people who did GAMS acknowledge that it's not, you know, the solution to everything, and that it's omitting a number of important aspects. But it still is interesting, at least as a general approach. So here is an example of what it would look like. So the goal is to edit text. That's a very vague goal. And let's say that one of the sub-goals is to select text that I want to move to another place in my document. So I will have to use three operators: moving the mouse, clicking the button, entering keys on the text on the keyboard. So for editing text, I may have several methods here. So one is to delete the whole sentence and type it again. One is to cut paste text using keyboard shortcuts, and one can be to use copy and paste or cut and paste using menu items. Now, one of the subtasks is selection. So to select text, I can go with the mouse on the text and drag over the text, or I could use double click to select the first word, move to the last word, shift click to select the last word. Now, for editing, which method between 1, 2, 3 I'm going to use will depend on various things. If the text is short, I'm often tempted to retype because I think it's faster than trying to copy paste things. If I know the shortcuts, I tend to use the shortcuts, and if not, I use the menu items. For selection, well, if I'm moving text that is a set of words, I tend to do 5, if not, I tend to do 4. Now, not everybody may have the same selection rules. It depends on your experience with the system, your work habits, and things like this. Now, what do we do with this? Well, what we do is that we can quantify the costs of each of these tasks. So we have, in the basic KLM model, which is one of the GAMS model, KLM is for keystroke level model, so very low level, I have a set of 6 operators hitting a key or a button, pointing at a target, homing, which is moving my hand from mouse to keyboard or keyboard to mouse, drawing a line segment, so a dragging task, essentially, and then the magic M, magic mental activity, how I need to prepare for the next action, which was timed at precisely 1.35 seconds. So as you see, all of these operators have a cost, a time associated with them. And the idea is that you can describe each of the tasks I was describing before with sequences of these operators. So the first selection was moving the pointer, clicking the button, moving to the other end of the text, clicking again. For copy, that happens to be the same. For these interactions, in fact, it's always, you know, pointing and clicking one over time. times. And then there's things about this M operator. When do you think?
When do you spend time in mental activity to prepare for the next action, to plan, or to see what's happened before and to decide what to do next?
Well, there are a set of rules that are described in the various papers, and they look a little bit like magical rules, frankly. So you can call them heuristics if you want to be fancy, but it's really black magic. What happens is that, again, referring back to this notion of action and operation and activity theory, if you're a novice user, if you don't know the system or not familiar with it or haven't used it in a long time, you will spend more time thinking about what to do next because you have the things that have been internalized as operations. So you will have more M's. As you internalize the system, use it more, the M's tend to disappear, and there's more chunking as well. Now, if we follow the rules by the book, then for the method 5, then 3 that I had before, I will predict that it will take a time of 14.9 seconds. Which, if you remember, 5 was double-clicking a whole sentence, and 3 was using cut and paste using menu. It seems to me that 15 seconds is pretty long for this. And in fact, GOMs often very widely overestimate the time.
And how is the keystroke model now related with the GOMs? Is it part of it? Or?
Yeah, it's one of the GOMs models. They present GOMs as a family of models because they... Now, I think they never really got much beyond the KLM model. Well, we'll see one that is more sophisticated, but the idea originally was to go from the low level of keystrokes to higher level to cover, you know, longer activities. So what they've added over time is a richer set of operators, a computer support so it could automate some of the things I was just showing, and the fine-tune the predictive power. What you do is that, even though it tends to overestimate the actual times, it is not too bad in comparing the times. So there is an exercise, I don't know if it's the one you did in the TA, but where you know you want to select text, and depending on how much text you want to select or how far away it is, the choice between doing it with the mouse and doing it with the keys, you know, the arrow keys, the model will tell you the right, more or less the right point where one is more effective than the other. So even though it tends to overestimate all the time, it doesn't get too wrong in the relative cost of each method. And as I said, learning is not taken into account, and because of periods of a fixed duration, it's also a factor of overestimation. Now, the latest thing I've seen on this was to really get a lot deeper into modeling things by taking into account really the type of parallel processing that can happen between your motor actions, your perceptual actions, or processes, and the cognitive processes. And so CPM GOMS, it's called the critical path method, was done by Boninardi. And Boninardi is the person who's done the most work on GOMS after it was launched by Cardmore and Newell. And so, as you see, they can do some very amazing accurate precision. So here is a plot that shows a set of actions. It's dialing a PIN code into an ATM machine. And you see the times of the two subjects, S1 and S2, and the time of the model, which is the black triangles. Now, this is very impressive. However, it has a cost in that you don't get this type of prediction by just, you know, doing MPK like I was showing before. This is the model you have to build. Now in this model, you have activities at the perception level, the eye movements, the two hands, well, one is doing nothing here, so this is the right hand. Cognitive tasks like verify target position, initiate eye movement, initiate click, etc. So this was eye movement, this is vision, perceiving the target. And at the world level, it's essentially deciding you want to start the action. And you have these timings, and it's really, you know what the PERT diagram is? The PERT diagram, you have sequences of tasks with dependencies between them, and each task has a minimum and maximum time, and maybe also constrained in the ordering. And so it's called the critical path method because you give it all these elementary actions at all these levels, you give it all the dependencies, it has some data about minimum and maximum time, and it finds the critical path, which determines the shortest time it can take to do all these various activities. So it gives impressive results, frankly, but at the cost of modeling even very simple tasks, you need to model it at a very, very detailed level. Now, I think what these researchers believe is that a lot of this could be automated in the future, or you could have templates or patterns, so you don't have to every time go down to all these elementary things, but you could sort of have predefined higher-level actions. So we'll see. But to my knowledge, this is really the most advanced work at the moment for predictive models of interactive tasks. And then I threw into instrumental interaction because there's no reason why I should be shy. I've talked about this extensively, so I won't talk about it more. The reason I put it there, I would have liked to put someone else's interaction model, but I don't see people who build interaction models. And that makes me sad, because it'd be good to have some competition. Now, to be fair, there are a number of people who work on developing alternative ways to interact with computers. So tangible interfaces, for example, tangible interaction, we use physical devices to physical objects to interact with online information, or augmented reality / mixed reality / hybrid reality, depending on how you want to call it. Also, you know, could be a basis for an interaction model. But I haven't seen those being developed to the kind of level of not just level of detail, but focusing on these descriptive, predictive, and generative aspects that I've tried to emphasize in instrumental interaction. And I think if they were to do this, we would see more of these interfaces out there. Because for designers, for someone in a company wanting to develop a tangible interface today, they don't know where to start. They don't have, you know, a set of articles or a book to read to tell them, okay, so how do you go about building this kind of interfaces? I don't think I'm there yet either, but that's at least my goal. I think for tangible interaction, for a lot of augmented reality work, people work to build cool demos, and then they stop there. And of course, you need the cool demos to sell the idea and to also explore it yourself. But if you stop at the demo, it will go nowhere. It will get lost. And we saw this morning, someone was showing me a pie-like menu in an app on the iPhone, which is done all wrong. And it's sad because with the same amount of work, they could have done it right. So I think it's a responsibility also of researchers to, and there is a very nice graph by Brian Gaines that shows the evolution of technology, where you go from exploratory phase all the way to the phase where things go sort of out in the world. But the exploratory phase is the first phase. Then you try to rationalize them, to explore variations. Then you condense them into a set of guidelines, principles, model, whatever you call it. And then it gets packaged in a way that people can really take it and turn it into products. If you stop at just the exploratory phase and you do the cool demo, well, you maybe have a bunch of views on YouTube, but it won't go anywhere. Okay, that brings me to the last part here, and I think I'm right on time because I'm not going to spend too much time on software architecture models. But I wanted to emphasize the fact also that HCI has a strong side connected to psychology and social sciences in general. It has its own methods and approaches, but it's also linked to software engineering and to actually building systems. And building interactive systems is painfully hard. As I've said when we did the class on toolkits and so if we go up one level from what I described in the earlier class on toolkits to software architectures and software engineering, you know what we get is not very sophisticated, I must say. So first of all, we have the CIHI model, which dates back to 1983. Which said something that should be fairly obvious, but still needed to be said at the time, which is that an interactive system is done of two pieces, one that I will call the user interface, and one that we'll call, that at the time was called the application. And the fact it was called application at the time is interesting because it meant that you have people doing the serious work of building an application, like kind of a database system or a payroll system or something. And then you had people who were supposed to build the user interface in front of it. Nowadays, we tend to call what used to be called the application the functional core. This is still called the user interface. And the overall thing is the application or the interactive application. But it's true that in the 80s, a lot of people were asked to stick core interfaces in front of crappy existing applications. So what CIHI did, and CIHI is just the name of a little town in Germany where a number of researchers had a workshop, and this model emerged from that workshop, to say that in user interface you have three parts. You have the presentation, which is what the user sees and where the user input goes, so it's a surface, if you want, of the system. Then at the other end, you have the part that needs to interact with the functional core. So if it's a database, something has to turn the input from the user into, I don't know, SQL queries or something of that nature. And in the middle, to control these two worlds, the world of the user and the world of the application, to still call it that way, you have the dialog control. And the dialog control, to me, has always been this kind of muddy thing where nobody wants to tell really what it is. And so the only way to think about it is what is not presentation and not functional core interface, you stick in the dialog control. So it involves things like how do you sequence things in a dialog, how do you validate input and turn it into commands to the functional core, and symmetrically how do you turn stuff that comes back from the functional core into stuff that can be displayed on the screen. So it's a transducer between the two worlds, if you wish. And so yeah, the functional core interface adapts the things with the rest of the application. Now this is a very monolithic model where you have three modules. And of course, if you start building complex applications, this is not a very useful modular decomposition. So other approaches have been more successful, at least in the marketplace, and the most well-known one is MVC. And so MVC is a model view controller. It was created when the people building Smalltalk created a graphical user interface for Smalltalk, and they built something from scratch. And so what they did was they built it around this modular decomposition where each interactive object, we call it a widget today, had three parts, the view, the controller, and the model. Now, this is not far from Seeheim. Hello. Hey, I have another 5 minutes.
We'll listen to your brilliant lecture.
Yeah, thank you. And you take notes.
I will. I brought reinforcements.
So you have, this is not very far from what you had at the Seeheim level, but instead of being at the level of the overall system, it's at the level of each component. So you have the view, which is how things look on the screen, and the input also goes to the view. You have the model, which is an abstract representation. So if your view is a scroll bar, the model is going to be the current value of the scroll bar and the min and max, for example. If you're editing text, the model is going to be the text you're editing and things like this. And the controller is a way to make sure that input to the view gets updates the model, and then the model talks directly to the view to update it when things change. So now there's a bit more to MVC, but that's the basic idea. And you create a hierarchical tree of these MVC triplets. And you have this hierarchy where a controller can control sub-components. So if you have a scroll bar and a text pane, then the view controller above them will make sure that when you scroll the scroll bar and its model is updated, it adjusts the scrolling position of the text. Now, people pretend today that they do MVC. The MVC that you do in almost everything but, I guess, the original Smalltalk is not really MVC anymore. It's more like this. So this is the pack model illustrated by Joël Boutaz, a French researcher from Grenoble. And again, if you look at the words, it's still kind of the same story. There is the presentation, there is the abstraction, and there is the control. So, you know, if it's just changing the initials by changing the name, it's not very interesting, but it's not quite like that. First of all, here the presentation is only doing output. The input is going to the control. And then the abstraction it's not exactly the same repetition of tests. And I don't really have time to go into the details here. But what I can tell you for sure is that when you program, say, on iOS or macOS with Coco, you're doing more pack-like things than you do MVC. Model. Because the problem you had in MVC is decoupling the model, the view of the controller was artificial. And in fact, people always use those classes together. Am I right? You have Smalltalk experts here, so you better be careful.
In the current version of Smalltalk that I use, they totally forgot about this.
Okay, well, and I think that is also a testament to the fact that, you know, MVC was great when it came out. And it's been evolving. So essentially, with pack, we don't. It's not very different. The roles are separated a bit differently, and in a way that makes more sense given the types of interfaces we build today. But it's the same basic idea. So they created variants of this, and particular Copack, which was for distributed environment and things like this. They also, and I think that was something that was missing in Smalltalk MVC, is they created heuristics. So when you have specific things to do, like multiple views of the same object, or coordinated things, or an inspector and the inspected objects, they had patterns. In fact, they call them heuristics, but they were really patterns to build parts of a tree so it would achieve this kind of effects. And in Smalltalk, this is not made explicit. I mean, people know how to do it through practice, but this pattern language was not made explicit. You had a question?
No, earlier.
Okay. So don't worry about this, which I skipped. This is a modern version of Seeheim, but to me it's not very relevant today. So to conclude. So if you look at the models and theories and frameworks and notations and things, and abstractions that we use in human-computer interaction, they come from psychology with focus on action perception and cognition. They come from sociology and ethnomethodology and the methods used in sociology to observe people, essentially. They are borrowed from computer science, like the automata that we use in state machines, and some are specific to HCI, like GOMS or instrumental interaction. A lot of the theories we have are rather descriptive. We have very few that are predictive. And there's a growing number, but still too few that are generative. And I think the important thing would be to go more through the generative part and maybe improve the predictive aspect as well. And as I said at the very beginning, this was based on this book edited by John Carroll, HCI Models, Theories and Frameworks, which has extensive articles on pretty much everything I talked about today and more. And so if you want to know more, you could go to the book or to the original articles. And with that, I will welcome my colleagues here. Do you have any questions while they get in?